It's 5 p.m., which means this is iScience Radio on IC Radio. Hello and welcome to the 17th of February's edition of iScience Radio. On today's show, we're going to be talking about some of our favorite bad science experiments throughout history. This will be science that was based on bad science, resulted in a bad outcome, or was just all around bad from the get-go. Later on in the show, we're going to be discussing some of the great science movies of all time that have had some not-so-great science in them. We would love to hear some of your favorite examples of bad science and or movies that you enjoyed that had some bad science, so please reach out to us by sending a message to IC Radio, and in order to do that, just go to icradio.com/contact. Stay with us now until 6 p.m. right here on iScience Radio.
The radio show where we talk about science, we have fun with science, and we play some really cool records. This is iScience Radio.
All right, I'm Skylar, your iScience Radio editor for today. We have Gina doing a fabulous job all night producing behind the screen. In addition, I'm joined in the studio by Andrew.
Oh, hello there.
Juan.
Hi, everyone.
And Harry.
Good afternoon.
Yes, and you can tell which Harry it is by that dashing voice. So, are you all pretty excited for today's show? I am.
Oh, very much so.
I think this will be fun.
Yeah, I'm quite excited, in particular for the bad science experiments. I know that we've had a sneak peek of some of the ones that you're going to be talking about, but I'm really excited to see how they turn out.
Badly, probably.
Yes, well, not the experiments themselves, more so talking about them. I'm also excited
hopefully
for
not
the movies.
Badly, then.
I feel like we're going to personally victimize some people when we talk about the movies. People are going to be definitely upset.
I'm not going to allow that.
Well, I really hope they write into us when they are upset.
We're slaughtering some sacred cows there, I'd say, so...
With what? Sacred cows?
We're slaughtering some sacred cows.
Is that a saying I'm not aware of?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We all use it.
Well, I hope we don't slaughter too many sacred cows today.
Well, I brought my favorite film along, so we're not going to be slaughtering that. I'll tell you that for free. And I'm looking forward to Andrew's as well. That one's going to be a real gift.
I have to say, I think yours is my favorite as well. So, but first, before we get started, we do have to switch over to some iScience news. So as usual, here with the latest science headlines from iScience is the news team. Today's news editors are Madeline, Gina, and Julia.
This is iScience Radio News.
Hi everyone, I'm Madeline, news editor at iScience, and this week I'm here with Julia and Gina from the news team to give you your weekly science roundup. First up, dinosaur footprints preserved in the mud of an outback ranch have been saved from floods which have ravaged Western Queensland. Coordinated by paleontologists from Melbourne, the rescue mission has been praised by the mayor of the town of Winton, whose tourist industry is heavily reliant on the tracks. Extending over an area the size of two basketball courts, the footprints of three dinosaurs have been taken out of the ground and will be kept safe until the floods subside.
Next up, last Friday, thousands of children across the UK took time out of their education to protest the government's lack of action on climate change. These pupils, many of whom are too young to vote, were joined by supportive adults as they demanded protection for their future. With potentially just 12 years left for the global population to change the fate of the world by putting measures in place to stop the devastating impact of climate change, children in Europe are marching every week, adding their voices to the global call to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius.
And finally, a story that has touched many hearts around the world, a 15-year space mission to Mars has finally come to an end. Last week, NASA announced that it had given up attempts to re-establish contact with the Red Planet's rover called Opportunity after it fell silent following a dust storm. Its last words, "My battery is low and it's getting dark," were shared all around the world, although that is more of a poetic interpretation of the rover's last transmission in 2018. It's fair to say that the rover had a great life and far exceeded its life expectancy. After all, it was only meant to survive 90 days on the Red Planet.
And that's all we've got time for here. Tune in next week for more science news.
All right. Thank you to the iScience news team doing an excellent job. In particular, I'm pretty heartbroken about the Opportunity rover, I have to say. Did anyone see all of the memes and backlash online after it was
like
announced?
Comics, yeah. It was pretty sad to see it.
Yeah, my favorite is, if anyone's seen it, it's the God at the gates of heaven, and he's greeting the Opportunity Rover, and the Opportunity Rover says, "Was I a good rover?" And God looks down and says, "No, I'm told you were the best." That's my personal favorite, I have to say.
That's very endearing, isn't it? It's only something a group of scientists would enjoy, though, isn't it? So I hope everyone else listening in is enjoying it as much.
Although I have to say, shout out to one of my best friends, David. He's not going to listen to this, probably. But if he does, he wrote to me. He's not a science person, and he wrote to me and said, "I just read about the Opportunity Rover, and I'm in tears." Albeit, he was probably a little intoxicated, but he was in tears over it, so I think it touches all of us.
I feel like it's touched more people than the impending death of the planet, which is quite impressive.
Yes, so, it has.
That's a big thing
to
say.
Talk about priorities, Andrew. Talk about priorities.
I'm not judging. Yeah. RIP Opportunity.
I mean, I am, but...
Well, that's a very chipper note, and I think it segues nicely into our first topic for the day. So, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be talking about some of our favorite or most interesting pieces of bad science that we think people need to know, and we're starting with Andrew.
I hope that I'm not the piece of bad science that you're referring to here.
Yeah, just you as a person, bad science.
You know what? I'll take that. I'm not going to disagree too much. I won't put up any resistance. What I will do instead is offer you a bit of a, not so much bad science, because I have to say, I do really admire the dedication to the cause that was shown here, but it's a bit of research by Dr. Justin Schmidt, an American entomologist based in the Carl Hayden Bee Research Center in Arizona, which I assume you're all familiar with. Now, Schmidt came up with the Schmidt Sting Pain Index, which, as you might expect, is a pain scale rating system. And,
ooh.
Yes, exactly. I hope that's perked your interest. And it was essentially to just compare the relative pain caused as a result of different stings of hymenopteran insects. And I think the best known of that group is probably the bees, wasps, and ants. So, you know, it's obviously useful, this index, comparing all of these things. And he showed great dedication. He's been stung by more than 150 species, and all together.
Now, I've got a question for you, if I can jump in very quickly.
Oh, go on, Andrew.
What makes a man want to start stabbing himself with different stings?
Well, it comes from one of those ridiculous sounding stories of one day, as a child, he was playing with an ant's nest.
Is this true?
This is 100%
brilliant,
true.
Brilliant.
Jesus Christ.
He was playing with an ant's nest and was stung, as one might expect. And from that moment onwards, he was hooked.
That is an absolutely cracking hook, if I say it myself.
And I wasn't planning on sharing that part of the story, so thank you very much for bringing it in.
Let me get this clear. He was hooked by the pain caused by his ant.
I don't think it was some sadistic sort of response to this as a child.
More masochistic.
I think the name for that is masochism.
But, yeah. Oh, sorry.
But the science behind it was, not only was he hooked by it, he was fascinated by it. He wanted to help people.
Exactly. And he did that by being stung more than 1,000 times by various different hymenopteran insects. And his rating system went from a measly 0 to a 4.
To a four.
Quick question. So does a 0 mean it doesn't sting? Or a 0 is like it stings but you don't even notice?
A 0 means it has a sting, so you can be stung, but it has of no consequence to a person.
There's no pain.
Not to a person,
it's just a symptom, perhaps.
It's just there is entry and that's it.
Good to know. So continue on with the scale or the story of how it was developed.
Yeah, of course. Because no one wants to hear about the zeros. Zeros are boring.
Let's jump to the fours.
Let's jump to the fours. And for a bit of context, just so everyone can refer to something, a 2 would be a honeybee. And I think if anyone's been stung, it's probably what they would have been stung by, a regular wasp.
I've never had the pleasure.
Well, perfectly for this, he offered a handy little description. So even if you've not been stung, you can...
Believe it, Juan? Here's one he made earlier.
Just give me a second. Let me whip this up and find out what he said about the honeybee.
While you're finding the direct quote, I'm curious. Who has been stung by what as far as in this room? Uh-huh. So we'll go ahead. We'll start on my right with Harry. Harry, what have you been stung by?
Yeah, I've taken a couple of wasps before in my time. I've taken a bee or two. I can't say anything worse than that. It's not jumping to the forefront of my brain, but I will tell you that my next door neighbour got stung by not one hornet, but two. And I imagine on the pain threshold that Schmidt made, that'd be pretty high, because apparently it can actually be quite, it can be fatal in some instances. Yeah.
So you can develop an allergy to the hornet poison, and it could potentially kill you.
Scary stuff.
Well, Harry, seeing as though you've been bitten, or not bitten, you've been stung. You've been stung by a bee. Would you say this reminded you of a burning, corrosive, but handleable pain?
You know what? That's exactly how I would have described it as well.
A flaming match head lands on your arm and is quenched with lye and then with sulfuric acid.
Is this what he's written then?
That is what he wrote about the European honeybee.
Perhaps you can say that one more time, because just to, for the listeners out there, just to hear it.
Burning corrosive pain, but you can handle it. A flaming match head lands on your arm and is quenched with lye and then with sulfuric acid.
So that's the zero.
No, that's the two.
The two.
I'm actually curious, how does he know what, like, having sulfuric acid dropped on your arm?
I mean, I've got no idea. I had no idea of what
did he actually, like, went over, like, how can I replicate this feeling, but with not, like...
Schmidt's there thinking, how can I communicate this science effectively? Well, that's I know what everybody's experienced.
Lye and sulfuric acid.
Lye and sulfuric acid.
So, no, that's a number two. That's a two. But the fours are what we really want to get to. And I think he initially described four, or the pain felt by four, as an immediate and intense pain that shuts down all illusions of life as normal. So that sounds fairly extreme.
Wait, all illusions of life?
Yeah, that's what he said, yeah.
He was a poet, after all.
So within two steps, you go from two, which is a bit of sulfuric acid bee sting, to this, four.
To this. You can think of nothing else. It does seem like potentially he could have expanded this scale.
So was Schmidt convinced that, you know, if you want to start a revolution or get people to think differently, just release what's a four on the pain index?
What's a four? Right, well, first we've got the tarantula hawk wasps.
Oh, these are the ones. These are the wasps that were in actually an Attenborough documentary, if I recall.
Yes.
And you see them killing actual tarantulas, and do they eat them or bury their young in them?
They lay their eggs, and the eggs eat the tarantulas. They're big black buggers with orange wing.
And they go, it's in Australia, isn't it? They're indigenous to Australia?
They're very widespread. You get them all over. You get a lot in the Americas. And I've come across some of these before. Never been stung by one, but they're actually terrifying.
Andrew, are you worried now that you have a tarantula in your home that you're going to have some tarantula hawk wasp coming and trying?
I would fight that wasp.
I think you'd 100%. Struggle, I'm afraid.
Anything for your tarantula.
No, I mean, they are terrifying. You can hear them coming from a mile off because they're massive things. So you can hear the buzzing. It's like you would expect from a bee, but sort of a lower pitch. It's terrifying.
I'm sure most of us out there wouldn't even think of touching a tarantula. So just the thought of this insect taking on one and having its way with it like that is pretty scary stuff. Can you name just a few of the other ones? Because now I'm hooked.
Right, well, top of the list is the bullet ant.
The what?
The bullet ant.
It's supposed to feel like a bullet when it bites
you, right?
Supposedly.
Okay. Supposedly that's the reason. And that pain is described as pure, intense, and brilliant, like walking over flaming charcoal with a 3-inch nail embedded in your heel. And I feel like
what is Schmidt doing?
How do
we're all fairly familiar with that feeling. Yeah, so like, you can imagine quite how painful it would be to be stung by a bullet. And that outranked the tarantula hawk wasp because it lasts for ages.
Oh.
Tarantula hawk wasp, you get stung, it's horrendous, but it's over in a while. Bullet ants carries on going.
Maybe yes, did he get stung in the same place every time? Or like it was I guess it's not the same getting a stung in the arm like getting a stung in the lips, which has a lot more
nerve endings.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's a very good point. I don't know. You'd have to ask him.
So from an evolutionary standpoint, what do you know by any chance, or does anybody know, what would actually make an animal get a sting that's that visceral and that powerful and that potent? Like, what could possibly push a bullet ant to make it so that its bite feels like a bullet?
Yeah, I think you're the one really to ask here, Andrew, but I'm going to take a punt and look at you as I say it. I would say it's just selection. So the selective pressures would be that if an individual comes along when it's got through mutation, you know, through this kind of luck chance in biology, if you're born with the ability to sting or to bite better than the other ants, then you're more likely to reproduce. And I think that's genuinely it. Is that roughly what you'd say?
Yeah. And I mean, with a tarantula hawk wasp, for example, I mean, it can sting you as many times as it wants, so it doesn't lose too much. It's not too costly producing the venom.
But certainly, there's a point in between sulfuric acid and bullet wound, or what was it, the three
a Schmidt number nine. Three.
I guess the experiment was a bit like getting a stung in the finger by one wasp and then having like the other finger drop dripping into sulfuric acid. Which one is making me more?
So just jump back a second as well, just to reiterate. Schmidt tried all of these.
Yes.
This is self-induced.
He's been stung by more than 150 different hymenopteran insects and overall more than 1,000 times. And he recorded this. But luckily, he was awarded for his perseverance and hard work with an Ig Nobel Prize in 2015.
This is quite recent then.
Well, the Ig Nobel Prize was, but his research was in the 80s and 90s, so it's taken a while for the recognition to finally come through, but eventually it did arrive.
So, and if I can ask, why did you choose this as bad science? Because it sounds like the science is pretty well regarded. And maybe in a way it's good science. What made you, when I said bad science for this segment, what made you think the sting pain index?
Well, I wanted to give him some more publicity. I wanted to get him on the airwaves, but also...
The man's put in his fair share, isn't he?
He has. He's taken a lot of abuse for this, mostly from the insects. So I wanted to give him that opportunity, but also his descriptions, although... quite entertaining, aren't particularly useful. The comparison isn't the most use, but you've got to applaud him for what he's done.
So the bad part there is the communication, getting across what he's done.
Exactly. And as science communicators, we can't accept that.
That's what the show's here for,
well,
isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, there we go.
We'll have to get some bullet ants and see if we can do a better job communicating just how much pain.
You know what? I think I've got one for it already. It's like getting shot.
Oh, yeah.
That does work quite well.
I don't know why I think of it.
It might be a bit on the nose, but we could toy around with it. All right, so our next piece of bad science, we're transferring from insects to some Russian language that I can't speak. So what is it? It's Lyshenkoism, is that correct?
It's Lyshenkoism, indeed. It's. I think we've all heard of Darwinism, of course.
Darwinism? Just for if we're listening out there and I don't understand, what would Darwinism be?
Darwinism is the theory that species evolve through time due to natural selection, which, well, in later years has gone into the genetics, into DNA, and how different physical and psychological qualities go from generation to generation. Lyshenkoism is based on a rival theory regarding evolution, which is called Lamarckism, which was developed in the early 19th century and didn't really believe in natural selection. So there's a very famous example with giraffes developed by Lamarck himself, who was the proponent of Lamarckism, that stated that giraffes just became taller due to sheer desire to get to the highest leaves of a tree. And
I
like
wish that worked.
Yeah, the hypothesis that an organism can pass on characteristics that it acquired through use or disuse during its lifetime to its offspring.
Sure, so if I ran really hard, and I was very good at running after trying, I would pass that on to my offspring.
Yeah.
So it's nothing to do with your genetics, just kind of how hard you try.
Exactly.
Lamarckism.
And Lyshenkoism was Lamarckism applied in Russia during the Stalinist years. It was actually quite funny because it was an entirely ideological rejection of Darwinism. Stalin didn't believe that genes were a thing. He thought of them as an idealistic concept, which was a very communist way of saying that it was bogus, and actually he was quite skeptical of Darwinism because he thought it rendered life unacceptably deterministic. So he gave a lot of support to a biologist, horticulturist, whatever you want to call him, called Trofim Denisovich Lyshenko, who was the one who introduced Lamarckism to Russia and who tried to play his policies onto Russian crops. It was a huge failure that probably provoked famine and food shortages. But again, this was Soviet Russia, so we don't really know to what extent it was Lyshenkoism or it was just mismanagement by the leadership of the country.
So how much So you said that it ended up not working out. So in what way? What were they trying to use this sort of theory in order to breed crops or in order to, you know, try and get more food supplies? What ended up happening ultimately?
They were trying to, I think they were trying basically to put the crops under stress situations in order to for them to get more like more to get a stronger and more able to overwhelm those. Like for example, they would start like they would go to a wheat field and start pouring a lot of water into the wheat and hoping that the grain recover would be more resistant to
resistant to drought
to flood for mm-hmm. example yeah to floods and yeah. Didn't really work.
See, maybe they just didn't push the plants hard enough. Maybe what they needed were some bullets.
And it was actually worse than that as well, because it became a tenet of Stalinism. They any dissenting views, which were in accordance with mainstream science everywhere else, were banned and were persecuted. So you had actually proper like. Very distinguished Russian biologist going to jail just for saying that Lysenkoism was total BS.
So they took a tough love approach on their crops and destroyed all of them,
yeah.
is what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's just an example of, I guess, how politics and society was driving the process of science as well. So it's always got kind of an ulterior motive and there's stuff going on in society as well.
And Lysenkoism has become catch-all term these days for like any kind of pseudoscience, especially when it's supported by established power or by government. So I think it's a very good idea to remember how it came forward and how it was maintained, because it protects sure. ourselves from the dangers of established.
And excuse me for being naive again, but whenabouts was this all kind of done? Where were these
this
experiments?
This was in the late 20s and the 30s, just before World War II, and during the worst era of Stalinism, during the Great Purge. So yeah, it was like Soviet Russia at the time was a very terrible dictatorship where like dissent was persecuted and no form of political opposition was legal. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the scientific skepticism became a form of political opposition.
And today, is there any remnants of this kind of theory?
Of Lysenkoism? I don't think there are any. Like maybe some of our listeners can contact us later to tell us about if they know of any place in the world where this is still maintained as a scientifically accepted theory, but yep, I don't think I can recall anywhere.
All right, well, there you have it. An excellent little historical lesson there as well as the scientific lesson. Please do reach out to us. Once again, if you do want to reach out to us, you can do so at icradio.com/contact. Let us know if you know anything about Lamarckism or Lysenkoism.
Lysenkoism. If you want to research it, it's spelled L Y S E N K O I S M, Lysenkoism.
There you go. And now to something a little less intense, but also still very important going on right now and a little bit closer to home as well. Harry, go ahead and take it over.
Yeah, sure. Something maybe a little less theoretical, a little bit more practical, and kind of coming up to the period of time where Andrew's talking about around 2015. A little bit before that, actually, it started in 2013. What I'm discussing is the badger coal. Now, you might remember, okay, roughly 10 years ago, this was the hype. Do you guys remember that? I know, Skylar, were you in the country? Did you hear about this? If you're
no,
in the States?
I was not in the country, and it did not, hop the pond there.
No, of course, it's something quite small. But we'll go through it. Do you remember it, Andrew?
I do remember.
And do you remember the kind of the debate that was going on?
Yes, Brian May was fairly well involved in it, I believe.
Uh-huh. So
Brian May?
Yeah. He's a big fan of badgers.
That's all you need to know, really. Who is it? Oh, I've got a question then. Are you a fan of badgers? Do you find them cute?
I do, much cuter than American badgers.
I have to say, I only know the American badger.
They're horrendous looking things, aren't they? They're They're terrifying.
I don't think as strong.
They're all meth.
I don't think as they could
I imagine
be.
What they feel like on the pain scale is a 4.
I know for starters that badgers were used in as blood animals in the till the early 19th century. So you had like badger pits where people would just throw dogs and badgers so they could fight each other.
I was thinking about bear baiting yesterday.
And this is actually quite weirdly topical because we are talking a lot about animal rights. Yeah. We're not throwing them into any pit like this, but. They've been culled for roughly the last kind of 6 years, and it's ongoing today. In fact, they're putting more money into it. And the reason why I bring it up is because, actually, the science behind it is pretty ropey. So first of all, we want to go back to kind of the reason why and why it's still ongoing. It's all to do with agriculture. The whole idea in 2013 or so was they believed that about £90 million worth of the taxpayers' money was getting pumped in to looking after cattle or subsidising the cattle that were dying from tuberculosis in the UK.
And these are those sacred cattle that we were talking about.
The sacred cows
that came up in the beginning of the show. Yeah. So, and it is important, you know, a massive part of our kind of society and our agriculture. And as such, farmers were getting increasingly upset. Now, this is where it starts to kind of get a bit mixed up, if you will. So what you've got is you've got politicians, you've got a government that's under pressure from a group and a large body that's upset about losing their livelihood. And perhaps they're looking for something to blame. That's not really for me to say. But what I can do is we can look at kind of some of the evidence that happened. So between 1998 and 2007, the government listened. And not only did they listen, they did something pretty extraordinary. They actually carried out an investigation. All right, I know. Yeah, they wanted to support their claims, which is pretty impressive.
Evidence-based policies.
Evidence-based, it's unbelievable. So what they did was they set up these kind of, these 30 different sample areas, kind of ranging on the west side of the UK, and they were small sample areas. And they went around and they tried to cull as many badgers as they could. Now, firstly, it was incredibly expensive. And secondly, it didn't work. Okay, so they did these 30 samples, it lasted about a year or so, and what they found is that actually tuberculosis increased by 20%. So, being the British government, what they did was they thought, fabulous, this doesn't look good, we'll just say it does look good if we change it slightly and we'll do that instead. So what they probably should have done was looked at it a little bit longer and done another study. They should have investigated why. Now, there's belief that the reason why it increased is something called perturbation, which is basically that if you kill a lot of badgers, in order to find a mate, the remaining badgers are going to travel further distances. If they travel further distances, they're going to bump into other cattle, they might not usually, and they might intervene in areas around there, so they're going to spread more tuberculosis. This is under the assumption in the first place, everybody, that the badgers are responsible for spreading it. And there still is limited evidence. So the whole idea of this investigation falls upon a principle that wasn't really thoroughly thought through and wasn't understood. Furthermore, the UK government turned around and went, all right, we'll leave it up to the farmers. So to reduce the amount of money they were spending on all these different sample areas, they said, we'll keep it the same, but we'll let farmers lead it. So the amount of information that's collected since 2013 and before then, it's not properly documented. Today, in the news, I've got The Guardian up, so as of 2018, they think they spent roughly £40 million on this. They want to increase it. They want to spend another £700,000 on it. And that's the story under which the evidence kind of doesn't support it, if that makes sense. And I'll come back real quickly, because this really does get my badger, if you will, is that what you're looking at, the reason why they start to walk so far, if you want to make it more effective, you need to increase the area. So you increase that sample area, okay, you make it, instead of 2 kilometers squared, you make it 10 kilometers squared, then it becomes more effective, because the badgers can't travel that far. So if you are working under the theory that badgers spread tuberculosis, what you need to do is you need to increase it. Again, there's no regulation, and all of this is happening, and it's not really in the news much anymore. So if you are thinking about it, you're thinking about your animal health and your animal kind of welfare and health and stuff, do go ahead and look it up, because there's some interesting stuff there. Ben Goldacre has a piece on his blog, and he talks it through in about 1,000 words. Really interesting stuff. really interesting stuff.
That is really interesting. Yeah, and I think one of the big takeaways, and this happens quite a bit. So in the research that you did for this, did you find that it was more the scientists pushing for some sort of answer, or was it more the politicians felt like they had to do something and then went and leaned on science that maybe wasn't adequately there? So who is at fault? If we want to blame someone or put the blame on someone, who would you say is most at fault for something like this?
That's a big question, Skylar.
Not to get you in trouble.
With all my authority. You know, I think this is one of those things where it comes down to community. You've got scientists working in conjunction or for the government. You've got the government being put under pressure by farmers and by animal welfare kind of enthusiasts or activists. What do you do in that situation? I think you look for an easy fix, don't you? And what you want to do is you want to please everybody. Say you're looking after animal welfare. So you go ahead and you do a study and you take what finds you can. But at the end of the day, you've still got that issue and you want to hurry up the process. I think the government's arm's been twisted. You have to do something. And, you know, talking as a zoologist, that's what I did, you know, with the focus on conservation at undergrad, is that they haven't even looked at the effects it will have on other wildlife. They don't know the interactions. And that is vast.
Well, and it does seem to be the case that essentially they just keep on commissioning new research, hoping that at some point it will support what they're doing. I know last year there was a study done by ZSL, commissioned by the government, which essentially told them, stop with the cull, it's not helping. And they just carried on with it. I mean, it's, I suppose, an issue of science being too slow for policy.
Modern day Lysenkoism.
Sure, and then just to finish this up, because I know we've got movies to talk about, which are deadly exciting, is that even today, looking at the statistics, they're all over the place. In some places, TB is increasing, some places it's not.
May I just leave the last comment, which is this: it's not the same, but reminds me a bit of this story about the British administration in India putting a cull on cobras, and doing so by putting a bounty for every cobra killed. And after a couple of years, they realized that the number of cobras was rising in India, until they found out that it was the locals were breeding cobras to kill them. And claim the bounty. Yeah, but many of them escaped.
All right, so some excellent information there. Mm. It's also very local, very topical right now. A lot of big intersections of politics and science, and sometimes maybe not thinking things through as much as we should. So if any of you all have any feedback for that, or if you have any of your own experiences with bad science or with badger culling, hopefully not too hands-on experience, please reach out to us at icradio.com/contact. As I said, we're just past half past, and we're going to go ahead and switch over now. We're going to play some songs, and then we'll come back with some movies. So the song you're going to be hearing now is Bunsen Burner by John Otway on IC Radio.
There's a rare isotope of hydrogen that gets us into heavy water.
It's the molecular structure of your DNA. It's basic organic chemistry.
I'm an alchemist, baby. I can turn heavy metal into gold. I can make an unstable compound. Oh, mercury explode. Make you glow. I can make you phosphoresce. I can burst your bubble. I can make you effervesce. Science tells us love's a chemical reaction in the brain. So let me be your Bunsen burner. Let me be your naked flame.
Burn, baby, burn.
Let me be your Bunsen burner.
Burn, baby, burn.
Let me be your naked flame. When I do my litmus test on you.
Oh, Gem Republic's two boobies.
I said it was. I said it is. And what I said is true. Check out what's in the test tube, baby.
Wow, wow.
You're my little pipette.
Wow, wow.
You're my favourite piece of apparatus.
Wow, wow.
In my chemistry set.
Wow, wow.
Love's a chemical reaction in the brain. So let me be your Bunsen burner. Let me be your naked flame.
When are we back? How much longer in the song?
There's a chemistry experiment I want to try in my brain.
40 seconds.
To the Bunsen burner, feel the heat of the naked flame. Science tells us love's a chemical reaction in the brain. So let me be your Bunsen burner, let me be your naked flame.
Burn, baby, burn.
Let me be your Bunsen burner.
All right, that was Bunsen Burner by John Otway on IC Radio. We thought it was quite topical because of the next bad science story that we're going to be talking about. Also, we figured bad science deserves some bad science music. And Harry was lucky enough to be in on that song. I had never heard it before. Andrew, Juan, had you all heard that song before?
I hadn't, but I really appreciate having heard it now.
Yeah, I got it mixed up with Burn Baby Burn, Disco Inferno.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. No, very similar in some ways, but...
very different, drastically different.
Yep. Truly a land of contrasts.
So, Burn Baby Burn, though, applies pretty well to the last science story, or bad science story, that we're going to be talking about really quick, and that is Project X-Ray, also known as the Bat Bombs. So, this takes place in the United States, I know, bear with me, but... what happened was during World War II, so in 1941, there was a dentist from Pennsylvania, which if you're not familiar with Pennsylvania, you're not missing too much. To be fair, it's not one of the premier states that people go to visit when they're
I only know it for Witness, the Harrison Ford film with the Amish.
Pennsylvania gets a bad rep. It's actually a great place, but it's one of those places kind of like Florida where the US likes to rag on it a bit. I'm sure you have those in the UK as well.
Yeah, yeah. I love Florida. I just have you know though. I've been there. I won a SpongeBob SquarePants toy once and I'm a fan.
What's the UK's Florida? Is it Norfolk?
No. Oh, actually, I suppose that would make some sense. I could take Norfolk for that.
Yeah, perhaps. I've got no comment on this Florida UK situation.
Well, we figure that out. So the Pennsylvania dentist, his name was Little S. Adams. His first name is Little, L-Y-T-L-E. And he was on vacation in Carlsbad Caverns, which is in New Mexico. So he walks in, sees millions of bats, and logically, Pearl Harbor had happened recently. So he was thinking, how could we weaponize these millions of bats, as one does? So he sent a plan off to the White House in January 1942. Now, normally a plan like the one I'm about to outline would not make it to the president, but Adams actually knew Eleanor Roosevelt quite well. So Eleanor Roosevelt, for those of you that don't know, she was an esteemed politician herself, but also the wife of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president at the time. So the plan actually did get to the president, and the plan, very briefly, this is a direct quote, strap incendiary bombs to bats and drop them on Japanese cities, end quote.
Mm. Yeah. Nothing.
So the actual idea behind it was that bats like to scatter, right? They like to find nooks and crannies. So if you wanted to limit loss of life, which is actually what the dentist had in mind, if you dropped bats with bombs attached to them, they would find nooks and crannies, destroy the buildings, and cause widespread fires, but maybe reduce loss of life. And that's a big maybe.
I mean, ethically, yeah, there's a lot of things going on, isn't there?
Both ethically and practically. I mean, bats. The bats I assume that he's talking about are fairly small things. So you imagine they can't carry a much greater weight than what they already have, so strapping a bomb to it seems, impractical.
You hit the nail on the head with the practicality there. So once the plans were accepted, because the United States during wartime is willing to throw money at anything, so they invest $2 million into this research project. $2 million in 1941, and I didn't look at the inflation rate, but I imagine it's well over that now. So the idea was based off of a psychologist and as well as a bat scientist named Donald Griffin, who said, quote, if executed correctly, it would have every chance of success, end quote. I don't know if it wasn't executed correctly or what, but the success was not there. So what happened was they grabbed 1,000+ Mexican free-tailed bats, which are quite small, as you alluded to. They strapped them with small dummy bombs at first to make a display at the White House, which promptly said, take our money. And then they went and conducted investigations in California.
So, and this is all whilst the war is going on, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Somebody's catching bats whilst the war's going on.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Someone, I assume, probably pretty low on the totem pole was not very happy. So the first thing they had to figure out, though, is how do we get the bats to not fidget around when we strap the bombs? So they stuck them in ice cube trays and cooled them so that they would go into hibernation while being shipped and while being strapped to the bombs. It gets worse. It gets worse. So as they were dropped, they were put in cardboard boxes that were meant to open as they were falling, with the bats then woken up, and they would fly out, scatter before they hit the ground, and find the nooks and crannies. Pretty insane. So they did a few test runs, and what happened is what you might expect. The bats woke up, scattered as they were meant to. Not all of them. A fair amount did not make the drop out of the plane. But the ones that did scatter blew up a general's car and burned down an airplane hangar that was at the test site.
What were they expecting?
Well, I think that's what they were expecting to a degree.
Not gonna lie, Pennsylvania man trying to destroy Japanese cities with bats is a hell of an onion story.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And the thing is, so they did 30 demonstrations after they blew up the hangar and the general's car and realized that most of the bats had not survived the drop. They did another 20 plus demonstrations. Invested, as I said, $2 million before it was finally canceled in December 1943 because they thought it would be a better use of their money to supply money to the Manhattan Project.
That's what they ended up doing with the money instead.
Nuclear weapons or bats? I still choose bats.
Yeah, it's bad all around, but it's one of my favorite examples because from the get-go, it was insane.
There's quite a few ideas of this. We were speaking before the show, actually, weren't we, about this one in particular? And we were talking about the Russian dogs.
Yep.
Uh-huh. So the Russian dogs were trained to run and basically throw themselves under the tanks. And they'd have explosives on themselves as well. What was pretty bad for the Russians, I guess, was that the dogs had been trained with Russian tanks. So in the actual war, they just threw themselves under the Russian tanks. And there's other examples. Crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. The military definitely, you know, has a big slice of the pie that is bad science. But now for something a little bit lighter. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be talking about some of the science in movies and sometimes the science that's bad in movies. So Harry is going to start us off with one of my favorite films.
All right. Oh, I love him.
He's fantastic. He made all the film
right,
for me.
All right. That was Matthew McConaughey. And he stars in a real good film. I think so. Of course, some of the scientific fans out there might disagree. It is, of course, Interstellar. And Interstellar, it touches on something really difficult. And most of it's theoretical. It's directed by Christopher Nolan, I believe. So such films as Dunkirk, Batman as well. Batman Begins. Batman Rises, I believe. Maybe all three Batmans.
They all three Batmans were directed, yeah. Prestige as well.
So he's got a big old group of fans. There's a lot of sci-fi stuff he
does. Memento.
Yeah, really good stuff, actually. Mm. And did you see Dunkirk? I know that's off topic.
I haven't seen Dunkirk.
It's all right. It's quite good. Anyway.
It's all right.
It's all right. Oh, you're so witty, it hurts.
I do try.
And it basically takes general relativity and it talks through space-time. Now, I'm going to put it to you before I go any further. You know, chaps in here. Hillary and Gina, if you're listening out there and you want to run in and join in at this bit, feel free. Can somebody try and define for me what special relativity is?
So it's
it's just dead air. That's what it would be. You think you've got to go?
Yeah.
All right, yeah, go for it. Shoot.
So it's a relatively special principle developed by Einstein.
That does sound
cool. So 200 years ago, Einstein came along and he kind of basically had the biggest breakthrough in science.
Yeah, about 200 years
through Newton. Through Newton, and just said, Newton, you know nothing.
Yeah, time is relative. I think you have to remember that. Sky
it's never ending.
So go on, though. So do you have like a brief breakdown of special relativity, or do you have more just sort of some of the flaws in that movie that people have been pointing out?
There are flaws in it, but I want to talk a little bit, and this is controversial right now, kind of about what they did sort of well. Because it is theoretical, right? The first thing that they do draw upon, and this bit's a really small part of the film, I've got about kind of three facts or so, and the first bit is the controversy when the father, I won't ruin everything for you guys if you're out there, I might I'll leave some of it for you to watch, but the first bit is the father goes to the school, and it's kind of based in the future, done in kind of a documentary style, if you will, and the father goes to the school where his daughter's been not behaving so well in class, and he is an astronaut, a former astronaut, and the teacher brings up the moon landings, so it goes right back to the US moon landings, and says they were a conspiracy. Yeah, so it's in the film, and it's kind of accepted, generally, that it's a conspiracy. And I thought, kind of what a brilliant thing to throw into a US-made film. It's not hyping it up at all. It's not saying, you know, we're great, we did this. They said it was propaganda used to kind of disrupt and completely corrupt the Russian space program. They wanted to floor them during the Cold War. Thought that was fab. So this kind of idea that maybe you can take something and you can believe against it. I kind of like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that has some bearing to it. And I think we're seeing that play out a little bit. So this movie was before the current political climate in the United States. But sure. The political climate, I know we wouldn't talk about transatlantic politics, but here we are.
That's a lot of things
always
going to
happen, Skylar.
We're watching you walk a tightrope, and one of us is ready to push you.
Let's not open that can of worms.
We won't open the can of worms, but I think Interstellar was a bit ahead of its time, seeing that there's a bit of division, and one side of this division could result in sort of this general distrust of science and things that we know as facts for all intents and purposes.
Sure. So, yeah, so interesting stuff from the get-go. But then it kind of brings in CGI, and it starts to talk about relativity. And the scenes in it, I think, are beautiful, the way they show space. And it basically talks about this wormhole that opens up. And the first kind of theory is that you can go through a wormhole and you can skip a load of time and end up somewhere else kind of instantly. Now, we always think of time as a constant, and this is I'm not going to try and explain everything here because it's too difficult, but we think of time as a constant, and relativity, basically, this idea is the idea of gravitation and it kind of disturbing space-time. So instead of being just flat and kind of like boring, it can bend, it can move. So if you have a massive amount of gravity, a small thing that's pulling everything else towards it, you can disrupt time. So the way they describe this in the film and the way they show it is the guy takes a piece of paper and he draws a cross on two opposite ends of the paper. Then he folds it together and he punches his pencil straight through. And he says, you know, look at this piece of paper, that's time. But by placing his pencil straight through it, he says, we've cut out all that time there, and we've jumped straight through to the other side.
Now, to be fair, though, that's a great analogy, but I imagine it's quite a bit more difficult to do it in real life, right?
Oh, unbelievably. And, you know, currently you've got this whole theory that if you were to try and go through a wormhole, you'd get spaghettified. So the closer you get to it, the more you get stretched out. So one half of you is going to be kind of stretched quicker than the other half. So it's not going to end well for you.
So going off of that, though, a famous astrophysicist in the United States, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he has said that that's the way that he wants to die. So if he could choose how he dies, he would be spaghettified through a wormhole.
You've got Neil deGrasse Tyson getting spaghettified. You've got Elon Musk dying on Mars.
And you have Schmidt over here just getting stung by all kinds of bugs.
How are you going himself out, Andrew?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about that. Spaghettification.
Spaghettification.
And
sounds delicious, not going to lie.
I was just wondering about our Lamarckism from earlier. So I assume that giraffes.
You're going to grow your neck.
your kids will have a long neck after you get the spaghettified.
Is that how it would work? Because if so, I'm going for that.
So I thought the way they tackle this, and they also do this this bit in the film where they're kind of going around this really large planet. And again, it's this idea of stretching out this loads of gravity. It's stretching space-time. So time isn't just a constant. It's actually being stretched. So for the individual that's kind of close to this anomaly, they're experiencing time last a lot longer than the observer is. I know that's complicated, and you do need to see it just to understand it. But just that idea, just to kind of reiterate, you're next to something really heavy, really dense. It's pulling space-time. It's elongating time for you.
To be fair, though, that one has a lot of bearing, right? So that from everything that we understand about general relativity and physics that Einstein set up,
sure,
that's very plausible. And the best way I've heard it described is if you imagine that you have a sheet pulled really, really tight amongst a bunch of people, and then you put a big ball bearing in the middle, Well, the sheet, if you imagine that as the fabric of space-time, and fabric's a great word here.
Fabric is a really good word.
So you have the ball bearing in the middle. That's a massive object that has a lot of gravity. It's going to bend space-time, and so you can. It's pliable. It's not just flat and two-dimensional.
And jump on YouTube, because it's all there. You put this ball in the middle, or you put a kind of tennis ball in the middle, you throw a little ball bearing in, and it'll be dragged towards the center, dragged towards that tennis ball.
So overall, what is your impression of Interstellar? You're talking about some of the things that they did quite right. As far as scientific accuracy goes, was there anything that really, really bugs you, or as a whole, do you think it did quite a good job?
Sure. So they Interstellar kind of tackles special relativity and this kind of gravitational waves in a really nice manner, I think. And it's done basically through kind of the visuals. So it's not so much about talking about it, although it is really science heavy. It's more about kind of what you see. There are a couple of bits, as I said, it's all theoretical. There are a couple of bits that bug you a little bit. If you jump into a wormhole, it's probably not going to end well. And as well, the ending to the film is very strange. They basically, I'm not going to tell you, I promised I wouldn't, so I'm not going to. I've done it before, I'm not doing it again. But it basically kind of suggests that time travel is possible. And again, theoretically, great. But they pack it into quite a small scene. So at first, I didn't like it. I don't know what you thought when you saw it, Scott.
I loved it. I went into it with big expectations. I saw it in theaters a bunch of times. It's just it's such a big, grand film, and it's got such great score. But it did get obscure by the end.
At the end, it's obscure, so it took me a couple times. But I can watch it now, and I enjoy the ending for what it is. And it's one where you need to sit down, you need to think when you watch it. So if you're looking for something which is a bit spacey, you're looking to sit down and have a think. I'd recommend it. It's got my seal of approval.
What do you give it on the pain index?
I'd give it 0 to 4.
That's a 3. I'll let you decide.
I would say it stings, but I wouldn't say you necessarily feel it very much. You know, so I think you're enjoying the film. So yeah, sure, bits of it hurt, but if you're looking for a bit of knowledge, then I'd give it a one on the pain index.
Well, actually, I really regret having not seen it in the theaters now.
Yeah, it's good in the theater, honestly.
It's
fantastic.
In
the cinema, it's mainly the visuals. I love it.
It's a beautiful film. I recommend it as well. It's definitely one of my favorites. And to be fair to Interstellar, they did a lot of work preparing the science, talking to scientists, trying to make sure it was as true to form as it could be, while obviously still being a science fiction film.
Sure, sure. All right. Also, Anne Hathaway's part in it is limited, which, for me, I prefer. Her and Les Mis, I wasn't a fan, you know what I'm saying? That's just personal, though.
You were trying to get us in trouble, right? So we do have a listener who wrote into us, and their name is Outrage, according to the screen. And they said, "Call all the badgers. They cause all the TB." So I don't know if they were listening as deeply as maybe Harry was hoping they would. Do you have like a quick one sentence response to that person?
I've got nothing. I'm coming up dry here.
Well, I imagine if you were to kill all of the badgers immediately, then you wouldn't have this issue of them having to travel to find more mates.
Well, you wouldn't.
Practically,
but it's
and ethically, we have other issues.
Even the evidence behind, you know, this is jumping right back, even the evidence behind whether the badgers actually cause TB or not, it's strenuous. There's so much information out there, and to wade through it. I will tell you this, if you're listening, a lot of the information that I get is done by a guy called Ben Goldacre, and he's the author of Bad Science. So if you want to see kind of where I got my information from, then jump onto badscience.net, just type in badger, 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 and it will come up. It says badger, 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 Carl, badger, badger, badger trial. See what you think then, and get in contact again if you want to.
I've really enjoyed this crossover with the Daily Mail comment section we've had. Yes, huge here.
All right, so if you want to reach out to us as well, please write to us, icradio.com/contact. Let us know if you think we should call all the badgers. And now we're going to get into something really controversial, because I know we haven't yet so far. And we have a little introduction to it as well. So I'm going to be talking about my movie, which is, Harry?
Prepare yourself. You ready?
Yes.
I don't have any more, I'm afraid. That's
and
all I've got.
If you haven't heard the musical stylings of Harry and his Ute before, that was a marvelous spot-on rendition of the theme song from Jurassic Park. So we're going to talk about some of the bad science behind Jurassic Park, and I know we're winding down here, so I'm just going to go ahead and talk about some of the biggest points that I found while researching this, and I know that Andrew's going to be sitting over there boiling over waiting to respond.
I'm just wasting.
So first off, the name of the film is Jurassic Park. Most of the dinosaurs are from the Cretaceous period.
Stegosaurus's Skylar.
I said most of them. So right out of the gate, that's not a good start, but... that's okay, because Cretaceous period, or Cretaceous Park rather, does not have the same ring to it.
No, it sounds stupid, Skylar.
I agree. So I have to give them a little bit of leeway with that. Now, for those of you that haven't seen the film, I don't know what you're doing. You're really behind the ball on that. But for those of you that haven't seen the film, the whole premise is that DNA is being used from dinosaurs. So ancient DNA locked in amber is being used in order to recreate and clone dinosaurs. They're put on a park where they can roam, and it's supposed to be sort of a theme park, and then chaos ensues.
That's not that bad, that bit at the start, though, is it? Finding DNA in amber. That's happened before, hasn't it?
Yeah, so they found DNA, but they haven't really been able to extract it. So they've found ticks. So first off, mosquitoes, like the ones in the movie, weren't around during that time. So it wouldn't have been mosquitoes. It would have been ticks. But in particular, the ticks would have DNA with them, but the DNA would not be able to be extracted and certainly wouldn't be able to use to clone anything, because you need the entire genome in order to do that.
What was the thing as well with using frogs to complete some of the missing fragments of DNA?
Isn't that in one of the recent ones? More recent ones?
No, it was in the first one.
That sounded a bit dodgy,
like the first time
I mean, it makes no sense at all. I mean, if you were to pick an organism that's alive today that is closely related to a dinosaur, you would not pick a frog.
That brings me excellently to my next point. If you were to pick an animal to closely resemble them in order to have a model species for the DNA, you would use, most likely, a chicken. Now, the reason you would use a chicken is because they're distant relatives of the Tyrannosaurus Rex and some of the other dinosaurs from the Cretaceous period, I remind you. And in particular, most of the dinosaurs that you see in Jurassic Park, in reality, would have had feathers. To some degree. Now, the raptors are a whole different story. They were wrong from the get-go. But all of them would have had feathers.
That's changed recently. That's come out, isn't it? It's a piece of research about these kind of feathers.
Yeah, so that's a big thing you have to remember with Jurassic Park, is Jurassic Park came out in the late 90s, right? Since then, we have had a lot of information. So a lot of the things I'm talking about, we didn't learn until after the movie came out. And I would even make the argument that we might not have learned if the movie hadn't come out. Because what Jurassic Park did for the PR for paleontology, the amount of people who saw that and thought it would be really interesting to go into that field, learn more, it had such a positive effect on that research that I'm skeptical that some of the information that we're criticizing would have come out as soon as it did without the movie.
Well, it gets a lot of criticism for those reasons, for not being scientifically accurate. But, I mean, I studied paleontology at undergrad, and I have to say, most of the people that I knew that also studied it, very similar to me, are big fans of the film. We're all people that have grown up with it, and it was a real inspiration. So I feel like people should potentially step back a bit and lay off the criticism.
Ethical dilemma. If you had the opportunity, would you bring him back?
Of course.
I would bring back my own personal Velociraptor, but I wouldn't bring back a lot of them. Just the one.
Would you be bringing an actual dinosaur, or like a heavily reconstructed species which would be like a Frankenstein monster of chicken?
I mean, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck, isn't it?
And it's feathered like a duck.
Andrew Dixon, science in general, everybody.
There you go.
Well, overall, though, it's one of my most beloved movies, for sure. I'm not so sure about some of the recent renditions. Have you all seen? Are you all up to date on all the Jurassic World?
Yeah, Chris Pratt kind of annoys me now.
He's a good-looking boy.
A different issue.
Yeah. The thing is, I can only see him as Peter Quinn, so...
Yeah, I agree with that. It's hard to see him once he's been typecast in that one role. Well... that's all we have time for today. We would love to hear from you once again on future episodes, what you think about Jurassic Park. We've had a great discussion over the past hour. We've tackled some of the bad science experiments of history, as well as some of the great science movies with some bad science in them. So thank you so much to our panelists. Thank you for joining me today. And thank you to our wonderful producer, Gina. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, follow us on Twitter @iSciencemedia and iSciencemag.co.